Okay, and welcome everyone to another Tuesday afternoon. Well, my levels are, I guess they're going to be okay. Don't need to crank it up to where everybody in the world can hear it, although that would be nice. Welcome to another Canceled Liquor Ball on Shake and Wake Radio, and also on PSN Radio and SoFlo Radio. Yeah, I kind of figured so. Didn't really need to, it gets up there where it needs to be. And I'm not going to get all that close to the microphone anyways, but I do want to say that all of these stations are listener supported, so please help them out if you're able to. A lot of brain fog going on right now, so I hope I don't have too much problems reading the book started last week, Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. And I will go back one paragraph to go over the last week's ending. And a travesty of reality, White House spokesman portrayed the U.S. orchestrated violence as representing a spontaneous, nationalistic, anti-Russian spirit of the Maidan demonstrators, as if they were supporting pro-EU and hence anti-Russian passions. But what evidently happened is that the coup leaders sought to jump in front of the anti-corruption parade by creating chaos and then restore order by removing politicians from the Eastern Russian-speaking region. I find it quite interesting that a lot of these political pundits are introducing the word false flag into the vernacular. And I don't know if, I do know. They have to awaken the people, get enough people to fight back at this fake revolution. And things are slow. We've only got about 5 years until Social Security gets cut off, run out, whatever the case is. And everybody, virtually everybody, that's probably when they're going to take all of the pensions from the police and the military and go hide in their bunkers. Yanukovych reached an agreement with the protest leaders to step down and appoint an interim government, but his palatial home was sacked and he fled for safety to Russia. The coup leaders, calling themselves the transitional government, fanned regional tensions by banning the use of Russia on television and other public places, and even began to cut off water to Crimea, while replacing local Eastern Ukraine officials with right sector apparat chicks, in an attempt to force the region's oligarchs and factory owners to turn away from their main markets in Russia and reorient the economy toward Europe. Matters have not worked out as planned. The U.S.-backed destabilization moves were so blatant that they promoted former President Jimmy Carter to warn that the rest of the world almost unanimously looks at America as the number one warmonger, that we revert to armed conflict almost at the drop of a hat. And quite often, it's not only desired by the leaders of our country, but it's also supported by the people of America. Commenting on the anarchy into which the U.S.-backed coup has plunged Ukraine. Singapore's Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong summed up what so often has been the result of foreign uprisings backed by the U.S. promises. I think you should have thought of that before encouraging the demonstrators on the Maidan. I think some people didn't think through all the consequences. Can you take responsibilities for the consequences? And when it comes to grief, will you be there? You can't be there. You've got so many other interests to protect. Having encouraged the Ukrainian coup by holding out quixotic dream of joining the EU and even NATO, the United States really has no means to follow through. It is in many ways a reply of the Hungarian 1956 uprising and that of the Czechs in 1968. The effect is to make the United States look like what Mao Zedong called it, a paper tiger. Having waved a big stick, the United States and its NATO satellites are now leaving Ukraine broke. The aim of prying it out of the Russians' orbit has left the countries heavily in debt to Russia for arrears in payments for gas, now no longer subsidized, and in danger of losing Russia as its major market for industrial exports. To cap matters, Western separatists are talking of blowing up the pipelines carrying Russia gas to Germany. Ha ha. Nordic. They're talking about 9 years ago. Ha. Wow. And other European consumers to reduce Russia's trade balance and thus presumably deter its ability to spend on the military. Very interesting. They were talking about blowing it up back in 2013. And America and other countries did. Last year, or 2 years ago, whatever it was. Jeez, it's been over a year ago now, I think. To support President Obama's assurances that the U.S.-backed side was not conducting the terrorism, the U.S. news media have blacked out the German investigation and similar testimonies. Obama's claims that those of Samantha Powers at the United Nations may go down in history as an analog to George W. Bush's fictitious weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. As Warren Buffett has quipped, finance and debt pyramiding are weapons of mass destruction. They go hand in hand with mass deception, opposition to the U.S.-backed coup, and its attempt to impose Eurozone austerity on Ukraine is not necessarily pro-Russian, but simply opposed to plans to tear down the country away from its major export market and fuel. Of all the post-Soviet states, Ukraine's economy is most closely interlocked with that of Russia. Even with the military production disrupting these linkages, can only be mass unemployment and austerity. The aim for Ukrainian anti-Russian turn, thus, is not to help Ukraine, but to use the unfortunate country as a pawn in the new Cold War. Snob word. Not sure which one that was, Mark. Could have been. Oh, the word I couldn't pronounce. Maybe that was. I don't know. America's Ukraine adventure as a new Cold War gambit. Why would an American president take so great a risk with his reputation. It is not to make a major geopolitical move for a showdown with Russia. The $5 billion of U.S. support to which Victoria alluded in her notorious phone remarks explaining U.S. support for the coup has been spent to fuel a movement dreaming of joining the EU. But the drive to turn Russia's naval base to Sevastopol and into NATO Black Sea port that stymied by the coup leaders' overreaching drive to ban the Russian language. In public venues, a majority of Crimeans sought protection of being absorbed into Russia, which Putin hardly could have refused. Failing to pry away the entire Ukraine, Plan B is to break it into parts, much as U.S. strategists are fermenting Uyghur and Tibetan separatism parts in China. Dismemberment usually is achieved most easily in today's world under the force majeure of IMF stabilization, such as tore Yugoslavia apart. An early venture of Jeffrey Sachs, the aim is to break away as much of Ukraine as possible from the Russian orbit, and to do so in waves designed to hurt Russia the most. This entails refusal to pay for gas arrears and stopping Ukrainian military exports to Russia. IMF and EU-sponsored austerity would lead to deeper dependency on Western Europe for credit that a bankrupt Ukraine, driven into deeper unemployment, could not pay. The IMF, EU, then would insist that its government must pay Western creditors by proceeds of privatization sell-offs. The problem with this is that most Ukrainian debt is owed to Russia, not only for gas, but also for other Russian claims, including a reimbursement of Russian prepayment for its Crimea naval base. The Ukrainian coup also aims to impose on Russia the kind of military burden that originally led its leaders to undertake their reapproachment. Reproachment with the West. Now there's a snob word, unless that was a misspelling. The idea is to drain its budget militarily by heating up the new Cold War along its borders, leaving less to invest in real economic growth. And if saber rattling over the Ukraine can taunt Russia into overreacting, this will revive fears of the Russian bear in the Baltics and other neighboring states, fanning their ethnic anti-Russian tensions. This will help keep their elections from being fought over a neoliberal austerity and the pro-oligarchy, anti-labor tax policies put in place since 1991. Like most national security advisors, Brzezinski depicted Russian resistance to U.S. geopolitical strategy as a threat to reestablish the kind of powerful imperial state that has become economically impossible in today's world, except for the United States alone. The U.S. aim is to become unilaterally global military czar or mother-in-law or whatever metaphor you might want to use. Using the IMF, ECB, and the EU bureaucracy, NATO, the covert operations of the America's National Endowment for democracy. And Freedom House to block foreign resistance to smash and grab austerity policy and privatization sell-offs. This perpetual U.S. national security nightmare suspects any industrial power of being potentially military in character. Hence, any nation with the potential to pursue an economic alternative to austerity is a potential enemy. To military game players, China and Russia appear to be the two great current and present dangers. Giving their industrialization control of their own resources and, most of all, financial autonomy from the dollar. Putin made it clear that Russia would be satisfied to see Ukraine as a federalized buffer state with regional autonomy for each of its ethnic regions. But U.S. strategists fear that this would enable the eastern region, whose export industry is tied to Russian markets, to resist the Eurozone austerity that would force Ukraine to borrow, default, and then pay back by selling off its public domain, banks, farmland, basic infrastructure, and industry to Western investors. The U.S. problem is how to convince Ukraine and other post-Soviet economies to submit to an IMF EU-financed order-imposing chronic austerity. The trick is to make Russia look like the major danger, not Western financial austerity and the kleptocracy it supports. When countries waver from following this policy, the fallback game is to make them fear the alternative, a combination of Russian menace and IMF-NATO punishment for not submitting. In setting the stage for the new Cold War global policy, former U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, demonizes Putin. Until his election, Russia was gradually joining the international order, by which McFaul means that it was on its way to becoming a U.S. economic colony, and its stock market leading global indexes and making fortunes for Wall Street investors. McFaul goes on to accuse Putin of a nationalistic reinsurgence, by which he means protecting Russia against U.S. smash and grab attempts to gain control of its raw materials. When he stopped, it's a Russian name. Khodorkovsky's sale of Yuke's oil to Exxon and its partners. McFaul admitted in another interview the reset's been over for a long time. When President Medvedev was there, we got a lot of things done that made Americans safer and more prosperous. The American national interest, that's what the reset was about. The reset was never about better relations with Russia. Outcomes were what mattered. Putin was demonized once Russia stopped saying yes. McFaul must be aware of Putin's own explanation for ending the U.S. dream. Contrary to George W. Bush's assurances, President Clinton expanded NATO into the former Warsaw Pact, members of the old Soviet Union. What ended the reset was Obama's violation of his promise to enforce a no-fly zone in Libya, only to have NATO bomb Libya apart. As Putin explained in a speech before the Duma, This disregard to rule of law was evident in Yugoslavia in 1999, when NATO bombed the country without a UN Security Council mandate. There was Afghanistan, Iraq, and the perversion of the UNSC Council on Libya, when instead of imposing a no-fly zone, NATO bombed the country into submission. They were cheating us once more, took decisions behind our back, presented us with a fait accompli. He said, adding that the pattern is identical to that which accompanied NATO's expansion to the east. The deployment of anti-ballistic missile system, visa restrictions, and numerous other issues. They are constantly trying to corner us in retaliation for our having an independent position, for defending it, for calling things by their names and not being hypocritical. Putin accused everything has its limits, and in Ukraine, our Western partners cross the red line. Foreign Minister Lavrov explained that contrary to international law and U.S. promises, Putin pointed out that our partners, Western states, despite having their repeated assurances to the contrary, have carried out our successive waves of NATO enlargement, moved the alliance's military infrastructure eastward, and began to implement anti-missile defense plans. Attempts by those who staged the succession of Kosovo from Serbia, and of Mayotte from the Comoros to question the free will of Crimeans cannot be viewed as anything but a flagrant display of double standards. No less troubling is the pretense of not noticing that the main danger of the future of Ukraine is the spread of chaos by extremists and neo-Nazis. Putin pointed out that our partners in Europe recognize the legitimacy of the current Kiev authorities, but are doing nothing in order to support Ukraine. Not a single dollar, not a single euro. It was Russia that was continuing to give it economic support and subsidize Ukraine's economy with hundreds of millions and billions of dollars for now. This situation, of course, can't continue eternally. In fact, Gazprom canceled two major gas discounts for Ukraine, normalizing the price from 268 to 485 per thousand cubic meters starting as of April 1. The gas dimension in Ukraine's debt to Russia. The usual Western financial strategy for making an economy's assets is to subject it to austerity and then foreclose and privatize. The problem is that most of Ukrainian debt is owed to Russia. Ukraine has never been paying for its gas this year. Prime Minister Medvedev pointed out that as president, he signed the Kharkov Agreement, and President Yanukovych, under the terms of this agreement, we extended our use of the naval base in Sevastopol for a long period, 25 years, paying $11 billion in advance. So on balance, Ukraine owes Russia $16 billion over and above the gas debt. There is a principle of international law in accordance with which an agreement remains in force only so long as the circumstances that give rise to it prevail. Clausula rebus sic stantibus. I think it's perfectly fair to raise the question of having Ukraine's budget compensate these funds This could be done through the courts in accordance with the revoked agreement's terms. Of course, these are high measures, but at the same time, the agreement no longer has effect. But the money was paid to Israel, and our Ukrainian partners must understand that nobody hands over money just like that for nothing. Okay, mark my spot here and take the first break. I think about a 4-minute break, everyone, so I'll be right back.
The love of God has been extended to a fallen race through Christ the Savior of all men. There's hope in saving grace. The love of God is greater, more than gold or silver ever could afford. It reaches past the highest star and covers all, yes, the world. Its power is eternal, eternal. Its glory is supernal, supernal. When all this earth shall pass away, there'll always be the love of God.
Okay, in my coming back into my bedroom, I forgot to close my door, so I hope we don't get any distracting noises, phone calls or anything. Yes, he is, Mom. All the time. At the same time, I reminded you that Ukraine's debt, public and corporate, to Russia is quite large, as it is. This includes the $3 billion loan that we gave them recently in accordance with our agreement to buy Eurobonds, and the nearly $2 billion that Ukraine owes in its accumulated debt to Gazprom. All in all, then, Ukraine's total debt comes to a very large sum. Vladimir Putin, $11 billion plus $5 billion. Most pressing, of course, is Ukraine's gas bill. Without paying it, may see the gas turned off. And if Ukraine simply siphons off gas being transmitted to Europe, a gas turnoff would threaten about 15% of Europe's gas supply. Yet this seems to be what U.S. NATO strategy is trying to bring about. If Russia stops sending gas to Europe through Ukraine and does not get paid, the ruble could weaken, spurring capital flight to the West and leaving Russia with less foreign exchange available to rebuild this industrial economy. Interim Prime Minister Yatsenyuk claimed that the new price for gas was an act of aggression and refused to pay anything at all. But he saw no such aggression in the IMF's demanding to remove gas subsidies for Ukrainians. But he refused to say no such aggression in the IMF's demanding to remove gas subsidies for Ukrainians. The rise in price evidently is to be blamed on Russia withdrawing its discount, not on revoking the domestic gas subsidy. The government's insolvency likewise will be blamed on Russian demands for payment of the debts failing due. That's falling due. To counter its double standard of blame, President Putin pointed out that the lowest prices were in effect at the beginning of this year, and Ukrainian partners stopped paying even at those prices. April 7 marked a yet another date for payments under the gas contract for March 2014. And they didn't pay us a single dollar or ruble for the $540 million they were supposed to pay. When Ukraine failed to pay the $2.2 billion payment due on April 7 for the March gas, Gazprom's CEO, Alexei Miller, pointed out that under the terms of its contract, this ended the special discount Ukraine had been receiving. It had been given on the condition that Ukraine would pay all its gas debts and pay 100% of the current deliveries. And it was clearly indicated that if this did not happen, the discount would be annulled in the second quarter of 2014. Prime Minister, I have trouble with his name, Medvedev, reiterated that no future shipments would be made without repayment, and President Putin wrote to European leaders. Instead of consultations, we hear appeals to lower contractual prices on Russian national gas, prices which are alleged of the political nature. One gets the impression that the European partners want to unilaterally blame Russia for the consequences of Ukraine's economic crisis. Right from day one of Ukraine's existence as an independent state, Russia has supported the stability of the Ukrainian economy by supplying it with natural gas at cut-rate prices. In January 2009, with the participation of then Premier Yulia Tymoshenko, a purchase and sale contract on supplying natural gas for the period of 2009 to 2019 was signed. Ukraine, right up until August 2013, made regular payments for the natural gas in accordance with that formula. However, the fact that after signing that contract, Russia granted Ukraine a whole string of unprecedented privileges and discounts on the price of natural gas is quite another matter. This applies to the discount stemming from the 2010 Kharkiv Agreement, which was provided as advance payment for the future lease payments for the presence of the Russian Black Sea Fleet after 2017. This also refers to discounts on the prices of natural gas purchased by Ukraine's chemical companies. This also concerns the discount granted in December 2013 for a duration of 3 months due to the critical state of Ukraine's economy. Beginning with 2009, the total sum of these discounts stands at $17 billion. To this, we should add another $18.4 billion incurred by the Ukrainian side as a minimal take-or-pay fine. In other words, only the volume of natural gas will be delivered to Ukraine as was paid for 1 month in advance of delivery. Undoubtedly, this is an extreme measure. We fully realize that this increases the risk of siphoning off natural gas passing through Ukraine's territory and headed to European consumers. Putin might also have mentioned that when Russia lent Ukraine $3 billion in 2013 to support its currency by buying euro bonds, it included the clause in the contract that stipulates that the total volume of Ukrainian state guaranteed debt cannot exceed 60% of its annual GDP. If that threshold is breached, Russia can legally demand repayments on an accelerated schedule, forcing Ukraine to default. This prospect seems likely in view of the Biden's coup, intended to break Ukraine away from the Russian orbit, disrupting its major export market. Ukraine's fragile economic structure and balance of payments. Reflecting the geographic stabilization of labor established in Soviet times, Ukraine is still a major exporter of military equipment to Russia. But Kiev's first Deputy Prime Minister, Vitaly Yurema, threatened to halt all arms supplied to Russia, stating that manufacturing products for Russia will later be aimed against us would be complete insanity. One report calculates that the range of exports includes the engines that power most of Russian combat helicopters, about half of the air-to-air missiles deployed on Russian fighter planes, and a range of engines used by Russian aircraft and naval vessels. The state-owned Antonov Works in Kiev makes a famous range of transport aircraft, including the modern AN-70. The Russian Air Force was to receive 60 of the sleek new short takeoff and landing aircraft, which now it may have to do without. Ukraine's oligarchs also sell steel and other industrial products to Russia. In the U.S. NATO plan, these factories would be sold to European investors to produce for Western markets. But Eurozone economies are shrinking as a result of their post-2008 austerity imposed to squeeze out debt service for foreign creditors. So the anti-Russian stoppage of export sales threatens to plunge the hryvnia's exchange rate even further into the even further than the 35% decline against the dollar in the first 3 months of 2014, making it already the world's worst performing currency this year. As Mark Adamanis at Forbes summed up the economic costs of the coup's anti-Russian stance, Russia has always had the ability to wreak economic havoc on Ukraine, and this should have made the West a lot more cautious about Eastern Partnership and the general effort to incorporate Ukraine into European institutions. In retrospect, the entire effort was to sign the association agreement appears to have been a rather reckless gamble, which no one knew the stakes of. To avoid a drastic collapse that would plunge the economy into deep depression, the West would have to provide much more generous and politically risky packages of financial assistance instead of all the IMF, Eurozone, and the United States have done is to egg Ukraine down the road toward financial catastrophe. Blaming Russia for Ukraine's coming austerity and new privatization sell-offs. The problem confronting U.S. NATO strategists is how to persuade Ukrainian voters to support the neoliberal austerity model of deep unemployment that will force labor to emigrate westward in a wave of Ukrainian plumbers. I have an itchy nose and it's bugging me. Good grief. Immigrate westward in a wave of Ukrainian plumbers, fanning the flames of resentment from the years of Soviet domination, is a tactic that has worked well in the Baltics. Latvia has just joined the Eurozone following Estonia's lead, and resentment of the World War II and post-war Russia dominance is so strong that the Russian language is limited to the 40% of instruction in secondary schools and effectively banned from public universities, with some small exceptions such as Russian literature. The Biden coup leaders are playing a similar anti-Russian card to focus the coming election on past sufferings instead of on how the coming IMF-dictated austerity will further impoverish Ukraine's economy. Well, it's being exasperated by my fan, Annie. It's hitting me just right, blowing my my nose hairs all around and giving me fits. I know that's too much information. A decade ago, Russian President Boris Yeltsin went to Latvia and tried to divert this attitude by saying Russians themselves also were exploited by Stalinist bureaucracy. It didn't have much effect. The trauma of Soviet domination was so strong that Russian speakers are treated as second-class citizens, many of the older ones without even being granted citizenship. The effect in Ukraine can be imagined by thinking what What Happened if Canada were to ban the use of French language in public documents, universities, and mass media. Such a move certainly would prompt Montreal and Quebec to secede. Likewise, if New York banned the use of Spanish and encouraged groups expressing a desire to start killing ethnic Hispanics. For neoliberal U.S. IMF NATO strategists, the advantage of fanning ethnic rivalries is to keep focusing Baltic elections on anti-Soviet memories instead of the disaster of neoliberal austerity programs. Paying off ethnic groups against each other has helped lock the Baltics into a pro-EU, pro-austerity program. Ukraine's leadership have been even harsher in closing TV stations that broadcast in Russian. Arrested and beaten up leaders opposed to the Maidan coup and deemed opposition to IMF EU austerity, criminal and separatist. All this has led Ukraine's Russian-speaking eastern provinces to turn to Russia for protection. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov claims that the United States is accusing Russia of doing what it itself is guilty of. The Western coup leaders are responsible for breaking up the nation, not Russia. I will leave these claims on the conscience of the American partners. One shouldn't lay one's own fault at someone else's door, as one report has summarized the coup leaders' behavior. Over the last week and a half, the Ukrainian government has tried to arrest every protest leader it can find and charge him with being a separatist. Conviction carries a jail sentence of 5 to 8 years. The banks here, most notably Private Bank, which is owned by the oligarch Kolomoisky, are limiting and freezing the accounts of people throughout the southeast region. For the last month, persons working in the coal and manufacturing industries have been told that if they joined the protest or even spoke about them on the job, they would be fired. And for the last 2 weeks, 30% of the workers' pay has been deducted to support the new National Guard, which is composed mostly of private sector fighters who have been threatening the population of the region. Yulia Tymoshenko was quoted last week as saying, "It doesn't matter who wins the presidential election, we all win. We all hate Russia." By Russia, she also means the people of the southeast Ukraine, who won't accept being ruled by an anti-nationalist government. The aim seems to be to goad Russia into act intemperately and with brutality, perhaps even to make a serious military move against which NATO can deliver a devastating response from the ships it has moved into the Black Sea. A Russian incursion would support NATO's claim that Europe needs its protection and also help keep Ukrainian and Baltic voters more fearful of Russia than the IMF and ECB. The irony is that NATO was supposed to protect Europe from the threat of military conflict with Russia. Its adventurism at the hands of the U.S. neocons now threatens to put Europe at risk while devastating Ukraine's economy. What blocks Russia from offering an economic alternative? The Euros... Turn the page before I start this. The Eurozone is turning into an economic dead zone. but neither Russia nor major European parties are proposing to change the regressive rent extracting tax and financial system that is imposing austerity and enables kleptocrats to bleed the post-Soviet economies, and toward which the West itself is moving. As noted above, one problem blocking both Russian and Eurozone opponents of financial austerity from presenting such an alternative is the U.S. ethnic divide and conquer strategy of playing to distract populations from debating the real economic issues at hand. Another deterrence is the Thatcherite claim that there is no alternative. Of course, there is an alternative, but without going back to the events of 1991 through 94 and rejecting the path that Russia took under Yeltsin at the hands of the notorious Harvard Institute for International Development, HIID, the U.S. Agency of International Development, AID, and the World Bank planners, all that President Putin can do is use personal persuasion. His attempt to stop the bleeding has led the U.S. press to depict him as a czar, not as a liberator from the World Bank, Harvard, neoliberalism. When he sought to rebuild Russia, he was accused of becoming an autocrat, blocking free markets. The American euphemism for a kleptocracy that has crippled Russia's ability to steer its development in the way of the United States and Western Europe industrial economies have done. Given the political alliances in which Ukrainian politics are controlled by an oligarchy, what can Vladimir Putin offer the country? What is needed is a full-blown alternative to neoliberal tax and financial policy. Yankovic rejected the IMF EU aid with its destructive conditionalities and of fiscal austerity and financial deflation. But all that Russia can offer Ukraine are subsidies for its politically gerrymandered oligarchy. In Russia, Putin used jawboning to urge the oligarchs and them to invest their takings at home to rebuild Russian industry, but without formulating an alternative to the financial and tax system, and indeed an alternative economic model, Russia can't offer a better economic system than its near abroad. The cure for a rent-seeking oligarchy is to tax away rent-seeking and to deprivatize public monopolies. What Ukraine's kleptocrats have taken and what foreign investors seek to extract can be recovered by promoting classical progressive policies, taking land and natural resources, regulating monopolies, and providing public infrastructure investment, including a public option for banking and other basic services. That is what drove the U.S. and Western European industrial takeoffs, after all. It involved a long political conflict with the post-feudal landlord class and financiers, and a similar fight must be waged today. By the time World War I broke out a century ago, a social democracy was winning the battle, and socialism appeared to be on the horizon. But today, the battle is not even being fought, and the economics tools to guide reform. the concepts of economic rent as unearned income and the ability of central banks to create credit is the same way that commercial banks do have all but disappeared from public discussion. Okay, mark my spot here again. First hour went pretty quick. So I think I'll take about a 6 minute break here. Be right back in just a few minutes, everyone.
Welcome to Scotland's Retreat.
Okay, and welcome back for the second and final hour today. Not going to have a third hour. I didn't get pestered by Jed Witham. So, I didn't contact him either. He's going to have to pester me if he wants some airtime. And he's good at doing that, that's for sure. I do want to say that all the stations, our listeners, are supported again. So please help Andy out if you're able to. Russia shies from offering a solution along these lines because that is labeled socialist, without enacting at least the classical criteria of a free market, a land tax, a natural resource, and a windfall gain tax on unexplained enrichment. It is hardly in a position to promote these policies in the Ukraine or Baltics. Neither Russia nor other post-Soviet republics in 1990 understood what finance capitalism and rent-seeking are all about, except for the gravitizers advised by Western interest. Of course, when it came to helping rebuild the Soviet economies after they sought Western support in integrating after 1990, the World Bank and the U.S. neoliberals promoted a neo-feudal political and fiscal counter-revolution against progressive-era reforms. The Cold War thus was ended by a lethal reapportionment between Western financial interest and local political insiders and gangs. It was the antithesis of political and economic democracy, yet this is still what binds today post-Soviet oligarchy to the West. Supported by Wall Street, the City of London, and German business, hoping to take the privatization windfall in partnership with the kleptocrats, since 1991, Russia has suffered an average reported $25 billion in capital flight annually, amounting to more than $500 billion over the past two decades. This is revenue that might have been used to modernize its economy and raise living standards. It was deterred by the failure to recognize that the precepts of neoliberalism are the opposite of what made the United States a Western Europe prosperity industrial economies. At the very least, Ukraine and other post-Soviet economies need modern versions of Teddy Roosevelt, FDR, and preferably a Eugene Debs. Economically, they need a Thorsten Veblen, John Maynard Keynes, and Hyman Minsky. Such voices existed in Russia in 1991, including Dmitry Lvov at the Russian Academy of Sciences. Many non-neoliberal foreign economists urged alternatives to the World Bank, Harvard promoters of kleptocracy. But instead of creating a system of public checks and balances, the Soviet Union refrained from taxing the economic rents. It was privatizing. The result was a travesty of free markets. Instead of the ideas of Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, another classic economist urging markets free from unearned income, economic rent, and predatory pricing, the West pretended that the antidote to Soviet bureaucracy would be neo-feudal economies, free for enclosures of the public domain, rent-seeking, and predatory pricing. In other words, Americanism. Do Russia, Ukraine, and other post-Soviet economies have an alternative to neoliberal austerity? In 1991, the United States and Western Europe did the opposite of helping the Soviet Union create a mixed economy, subsidize industry for a progressive tax system, and keep natural resource rent, land, rent, and financial gains in the public domain rather than being privatized. What the West wanted was to extract these rents for its own investors. Russia was turned into an exporter of oil and gas, metals and other raw materials, while weakening its industrial ability to withstand U.S. NATO military encirclement. What is needed today is to restore a natural resource wealth and post-Soviet land and infrastructure from oligarchs sending their takings abroad is a tax code of land and resource rents for starters. What has been relinquished can be recovered to finance public investment to rebuild their economies. This was the essence of the successful Western model, which saw industrial capitalism evolve towards socialism. It is the antithesis of neoliberalism. Given the hesitancy of wealthy individuals to give up what they have taken, governments probably need to leave them with the wealth they have taken abroad. But new bleeding can be stopped by the rent tax to recapture the pre-1990 economic patrimony that has been relinquished to the oligarchs and via them to foreign investors. The economic rent that Wall Street envisions being paid out as dividends will be taxed away legally under international law by the tax code distinguishing economic rent for profits for the new man-made capital investments and production. Neoliberals will denounce this policy as if it signals a return to Soviet Stalinism, as if this ever were Marxist. To neoliberals, kleptocracy and neo-feudalism are simply a final stage of socialism. But their present system is more an ideological coup d'etat imposed on the former Soviet Union in a moment when delusions with bureaucratic collectivism was at its peak. Reading the Communist Manifesto should dispel any thought that Russians have more familiarity with Marxist economics, or for that matter, that the classic political economy out of which Marxism emerged. Marx and Engels prescribed the positive achievement in capitalism as bringing bourgeois Europe out of feudal lordism and inherited wealth. The ghost of Marx might have spoken to Gorbachev, advising him to pave the ground for industrial capitalism by enacting at least the reforms that Europe's 1948 revolution advocated, taxing economic rent, followed by instituting consumer protection laws, establishing labor unions, and public banking to take the power of the fiat credit creation away from foreign creditors. The political problem of neoliberalism is how to deter voters from acting in their self-interest among these lands. In Latvia and Ireland, voters have submitted to the anti-labor, anti-government policies of global finance. Neoliberals have come to see that they can win at the polls by imposing even more austerity when we are dealing with something like the Stockholm Syndrome. Most typically, when kidnapped, victims took to their kidnappers for protection. Poverty begets fear, prompting the weak to vote out servility to the rich, or against each other in ethnic rivalries. The wider the polarization, the more poor victims rely on their exploiters, hoping to survive by becoming abject clients of the predatory patronage system. This means that the further economic inequity widens and the more a population is ground down into poverty and debt, the more the weak identify their interest with those of their oppressors. They believe that their best hope is that somehow the rich will reciprocate by accepting them in a patronage system. The effect of this to demoralize population is, and make them so fearful that they feel even more dependent on their oppressors, whom they hope to see how obediently they are behaving and will treat them better. The past century has a counter-revolution. The past century has seen a counter-revolution against the Enlightenment. Classical economies and its culmination of socialist hopes to steer industrial capitalism to evolve into democratic socialism. What is occurring today is a self-destructive financial dynamic of impoverishment, dependency, and breakdown, in many ways like what happened when Rome's creditor oligarchy plunged the empire into the Dark Age 2,000 years ago. The post-feudal real estate and financial oligarchies, the landed aristocracies of Europe, and the great banking families and American trust builders have made a comeback, and the new Cold War is extended to lock in their victory. Ukraine is simply the latest battlefield, and battlefields end up devastating. Obama's Ukrainian power grab, sanctions, and the boomerang effect, by James Petraeus. He was a general Petraeus, or I should say General Betrayus. Introduction. In the biggest power grab since George Bush seized Eastern Europe and converted it into NATO bastion confronting Russia, the Obama regime, together with the EU, financed and organized a violent push in the Ukraine, which established a puppet regime in Kiev. In response to citizens of the autonomous Crimean region fearing the onslaught of culture and political regression, organized self-defense militias, and pressured the administration of the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, to help protect them from armed incursions by the NATO-backed coup regime in Kiev. Russia responded to the Crimean appeal with promises of military assistance, effectively halting further Western absorption of the entire region. Immediately following the proxy push, the entire US-EU propaganda machine spun into high gear. The nature of the Western power grab of the Ukraine was ignored. Russia's defense action in Crimea became the focus of media and Western government attacks. Unconditional support for the violent seizure of the Ukraine by the U.S. and EU-backed coup was broadcast by the West entire stable of journalistic hacks and accompanied by screeds calling for measures to destabilize the Russian Federation itself through a full-scale economic and diplomatic war. The U.S. and EU convoked meetings and press conferences calling for trade and investment sanctions. Threats emerged from the White House and Brussels calling for a freeze of Russia assets. In Western banks, if Moscow did not hand over the Crimea to the coup regime in Kyiv, Russian capitulation became the price of mending East-West ties. The Obama regime, I like the way he put that, regime, or like a cabal. The Obama regime and the host of U.S. congresspeople, media pundits, and policy advisors called for or engaged in imposing sanctions on strategic sectors of the Russian economy, including its financial assets in the West. Opinions in Europe divided over this issue. England, France, and the rabidly anti-Russian regimes of Central Europe, especially Poland and the Czech Republic, pushed for harsh sanctions, while Germany, Italy, and the Netherlands were more measured in their response. The Washington-based advocates for imposing sanctions against Russia view this as an opportunity to, one, punish Russia for acceding to the Crimean autonomous government's call for defense against Kyiv, pushed, P-U-T-S-C-H. That's the third time you use that word. I'm not sure what it is. Probably another snob word. Punish Russia for acceding to the Crimean autonomous government's call for defense against the Kyiv, Putsch, by activating Russian troops stationed in the region. Two, weaken Russia's economy and isolate it politically from its major Western trading and investment partners. Three, legitimize the violent seizure of power by neoliberal and neo-Nazi clients of the U.S. And four, promote destabilization with the borders of the Russian Federation. At a minimum, economic sanctions have become an aggressive tool for energizing the corrupt pro-Western elites and oligarchs in Russia to influence the Putin government to accept the de facto regime in Kyiv and deliver the autonomous Crimean nation into their hands. Sanctions are seen by the White House advisors as, one, projecting U.S. power, two, securing the Ukraine as a strategic base for NATO, three, ethnically cleansing this diverse and complicated region of its Russian-speaking minority, and four, opening the Ukraine for the wholesale plunder of its economic and natural resources by Western multinational corporations. The Obama regime cites the success of the financial and economic sanctions against Iran as a model for what can be achieved with Russia: a weakened economy, diminished of its trade, destabilizing its currency and provoking consumer scarcities and mass unrest. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is pushing for more extreme forms of economic reprisal, trade, and investment sanctions, which obviously could lead to a break in diplomatic relations. Impact of sanctions on Russia and the U.S. and EU. Energy and financial sanctions on Russia, assuming that they can be imposed, would have a severe impact on Russian energy companies, its oligarchs, and bankers. Trade and investment agreements would have to be abrogated. As a result, Europe, which relies on Russian oil and gas imports for 30% of its energy needs, would slip back into economic recession. The U.S. is in no position to replace its energy shortfalls. In other words, trade and investment sanctions against the Russian Federation would have a boomerang effect, especially against Germany, the economic locomotive of the European Union. Financial sanctions would hurt the corrupt Russian oligarchs, who have stashed away tens of billions of euros and pounds in European real estate, business investments, sport teams, and financial institutions. Sanctions and a real freeze of the overseas assets of the Russian billionaires would curtail all those profitable sanctions for major Western financial institutions such as Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, and other giants of Wall Street, as well as in the City of London. In punishing Putin, the EU would also be spitting on itself. Sanctions might weaken Russia, but they would also precipitate an economic crisis in the EU and end its fragile recovery. Russia's response to sanctions. Essentially, the Putin administration can take one of two polar responses to the US-EU sanctions. It can capitulate and withdraw from Crimea, sign an agreement on its military base, knowing full well that NATO will not comply, and accept its own international status as a quasi-vassal state, incapable of defending its allies and borders. Or the Putin administration can prepare a reciprocal set of counter-sanctions, confiscate Western investments, freeze financial assets, renege on debt payments, and renationalize major industries. The Russian state would be strengthened at the expense of the neoliberal and pro-Western oligarchical sectors of Russia's policy elite. Russia could terminate its transport and base agreements with the U.S., cut off the Pentagon's Central Asia supply routes to Afghanistan. President Putin could end sanctions with Iran, weakening Washington's negotiating position. Finally, Russia could actively support dissonant anti-imperialist movements in the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America, while strengthening its support for the Syrian government as it defends itself from U.S.-supported violent jihadists. And I'll take another break right here. Seem to be zipping along here, folks. Let me see here. I think a couple of short songs. About 5.5 minutes, everyone. So, be right back.
Prepare.
Sorry for that long bit of silence there. I was texting somebody that texted me back. I should have waited. But going to continue on about the last 20-some-odd minutes, 21, 22 minutes of the show here. Shouldn't be trying to look at that text, that response. Get back to the book reading. Did Luca leave? I thought I heard him say something about good reading or... Oh, there you are. Well, that was just a few extra seconds. I was looking for my mouse and looking for the microphone. In other words, the U.S.-EU sanctions, while attempting to undermine Russia, could actually radicalize Moscow's domestic and foreign policy and marginalize the currently pro-Western oligarchs who had influenced the hitherto conciliatory policies of the Putin Medvedev administrations. The EU and Obama might consolidate their hold over the Ukraine, but they have plenty to lose on the global scale. Moreover, the Ukraine will likely turn into a highly unstable vassal state of the NATO planners. EU, US, and IMF loans for the bankrupt regime are conditional on 140% cutbacks on energy and gas subsidies. 250% cuts in public sector pensions payments. Wow. 3 major increases in consumer prices, and 4 the privatization plunder of public firms. Wow. They want Europe to go full on US. That's what they want. The result will be large-scale job loss and huge jump in unemployment. Yeah. Neoliberal austerity programs will further erode the living standards of most wage and salary workers and likely antagonize the neo-Nazi popular base, provoking new rounds of violent mass protest. The West could move forward with agreements with their Ukraine clients at the top, but face bitter conflicts below. The prospect of Brussels and the IMF dictating devastating economic policies as part of a austerity program on the masses of Ukraine citizens will make a mockery of the puffed-up nationalist slogans of the far-right pushist. Economic collapse. Can somebody look up that word for me, please? It's obviously either Russian or Ukrainian or something. P-U-T-S-C-H-I-S-T-S. Economic collapse, political chaos, and new round of social upheaval will erode the political gains assumed in the power grab of February 2014. Conclusion. The unfolding of the EU, of the US-EU-Russian conflict over the Ukraine has far-reaching consequences, which will define the global configuration of power and foster new ideological alignments. Western sanctions will directly hit the Russian capitalist and strengthen a collectivist turn. Western sanctions will directly hit Russian capitalists and strengthen a collectivist turn. The Western power grab of the soft underbelly of Russia could provoke greater Russian support for insurgent movements challenging Western hegemony. Sanctions could hasten greater Sino-Russian trade and investment ties, as well as military cooperation agreement. Western sanctions will directly hit Russian capitalists and I just read that. Much depends on Obama and the EU's calculation of another weak and pusillanimous response to the Russian government. They are confident that the Russian Federation will once again, as in the past, bluster and object to Western expansionist moves, but will ultimately capitulate. If these calculations are wrong, if the West goes through with financial and energy sanctions, and President Putin makes a robust riposte, we are headed into the eye of a new political storm in which a polarized world will witness new class, national, and regional conflicts. Ukraine and the Regime Change, Michael Parenti, by Michael Parenti. In early 2014, more than 83% of the qualified voters of Crimea, on their own volition, participated in a referendum to rejoin Russia, and that number, nearly 97%, voted to separate themselves from Ukraine and once again become part of Russia. In what was a massively one-sided victory, returning to Russia meant better wages and better pensions and somewhat better living conditions. The eagerness to reconnect was not anchored totally in ethnic emotionality. Crimean voters also hoped for a better standard of living. It should be remembered that Crimea would never have pursued such an action, and Russia would never have been receptive to such a course, were it not that Ukraine was in a grip of disruptive forces that were driving toward regime change. Regime change is a form of action designed to make it impossible for the existing government to govern. We have seen this well-orchestrated chaos and endless disruption in various countries. Militantly organized groups and financed and equipped by outside Western interest. NGOs service in substantial numbers and produce rebellious publications and events designed to unsettle the besieged government. In Ukraine's case, a government that was democratically elected not long before. The NGOs handle billions of dollars worth of supplies used to mobilize and sustain the protests. Just like here in America. Even though they are supposed to be independent, non-governmental, some NGOs get all their funds from the U.S. government. As Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland proudly exclaimed, "The United States has poured some $5 billion into the struggle for a regime change." Ultra-nationalists and mercenaries soon took hold of the protesting crowds and set the direction and pace of action, secure in the knowledge that they had the powerful reach of the Western nations at their backs. This included NATO's military might and the Western corporate and public mainstream media, with a global reach that pretty much shut out any contrary viewpoint. The most retrogressive elements among these operatives in Kiev launched slanderous attacks against Jews, blacks, Chinese, Muscovites, and of course, communists. In Ukraine, crypto-fascist groups like Svoboda, the right sector, and others secured ample funds to keep thousands of people fed and comfortable enough on the streets of Kiev for weeks at a time. Complete with well-made marching flags, symbols, and signs in various languages, including English. Svoboda henchmen were being financed by someone. They wore insignia that bore a striking resemblance to the swastika. Svoboda's top leaders openly denounced Russian scum and the Muscovite Jewish mafia. Disguised men in unmarked combat fatigues attacked unarmed police and security guards. They moved among the gathered crowd and at times, according to independent sources, delivered sniper shots into the crowd, which could then be readily blamed on a heavily asphyxiated government. Meanwhile, the Western media reported everything the way the White House wanted. For instance, unfailing reference to the perpetrators as protesters. This manufactured uprising in Kiev is something we have seen in numerous other countries, from Venezuela to Thailand, during their very same time frame. During this very same time frame, the scenario is much the same, and the goal of these Western financed attacks have been to make the world safe for the 1%, the global super rich. Ukraine citizens who think they are fighting for democracy will eventually discover that they are really serving the Western plutocracy. They will be left with a new government filled with old intentions. Ukrainians will end up with nothing to show for their efforts except a still more depressed and more corrupt economy, as enormous IMF debt, a worsening of social services, and an empty democracy led by corrupt neo-Nazis and ultra-nationalists. Russia has stepped in on behalf of Russian Crimea, and Russia does not seem quite ready to leave eastern Ukraine in the mercy of the regime changers. So Russia is now maligned by the Western plutocrats who seek ways to put Moscow in isolated retreat. Putin is denounced and demonized at every turn. What exactly have been the demonic moves Putin have committed? Specifics are seriously wanting. What we have witnessed is a long-standing ploy of U.S. global aggrandizing. When confronted by a country or a political movement that decides to work on out its own problems, a country that does not open its land, labor, natural resources, and a capital, the U.S. empires voraciously embrace. U.S. leaders play the heroic rescuers. The leaders of such countries and movements are demonized. Castro, Mossadegh, Allende, Aristide, Noriega, Milosevic, Gaddafi, Hugo Chavez, and others too numerous to mention. I can mention them. There's like 47 other countries that have fell because of U.S. interest. Leaders who serve U.S. interest by killing off and otherwise... he goes right into what I just said. Leaders who serve U.S. interest by killing off and otherwise repressing the democratic reformers in their countries are hailed as friends and heroes, as for instance was Saddam Hussein, hailed by Washington until he started asking for a larger oil quota. Those leaders who step out of line, as did Saddam, are committed to economic nationalism, refusing to throw open the land, labor, capital, and resources of their countries to the Western investors, are demonized and targeted, depicted as purveyors of mass destruction and whatever other terrorist menace Once a leader is properly demonized, the U.S. empire builders exercise their presumed license to bomb his people. So with Ukraine in Kiev all through January and February of 2014, the ominously dressed and masked squads that threw firebombs and sniped from windows and roofs were uncritically and ever respectively described as protesters and demonstrators by the Western mainstream media. The American Confederacy flag and the KKK symbols they hung in the Parliament building after they took it over by force were pictured on the internet by freelancers, but never mentioned or shown in the corporate news. The protesters waged a forceful and successful takeover of a democratically elected government, a government that was promised new elections in a few months. This regime change campaign earned nary a critical utterance from the U.S. mainstream media. But in March 2014, Russian-speaking citizens in eastern Ukraine who engaged in demonstrations and municipal building takeovers were immediately labeled terrorists and militant agitators bent on making trouble for the Kiev authorities. And what of the wicked Putin? How really wicked is he? Has anyone in the U.S. media ever read Putin's speeches? If so, they are keeping it a secret. Putin's utterances are so much more clear in saying that the twisty pretenses put up by Obama. Take an instance, Obama's Brussels speech of March 2014 at the Polaris de Beaux-Arts, in which he dared to claim with a straight face that the United States has saved and democratized Iraq. In Iraq, the president and his cohorts did not grab control. He reassured his EU audience, "We left Iraq to its people in a fully sovereign state." No, we left Iraq with a million casualties, hundreds of thousands of in destruction, a shattered infrastructure, a breakdown of public safety, and a demoralized population choking on a wrenched sectarian violence. In the same speech, Obama asserted that Washington selflessly left obliged to help Ukraine. He noted that issues in Ukraine did not infringe upon U.S. interest. Still, the United States had a commitment to international law and into humanitarian rights of all nations, even poor little ones, or maybe especially poor little ones. We cannot turn our backs on similar nations. But Russia is obliged to turn its back on Crimea. Obama was unswerving in his claim that the United States was dedicated to fighting the bully, and in this instance, the bully was Russia. Led by bully boy Putin, Russia must learn, Obama went on, that it cannot run roughshod over its neighbors, and it should accomplish nothing through brute force. Advice not preferred to the Kiev regime changers themselves. Furthermore, Obama reminded us we Americans need to defend democracy, except when we impose regime change on an elected democratic government, as in Ukraine. Moscow's invasion of Ukraine was a violation of international law, and it's deserving of all sanctions imposed upon Russia and more to come. Meanwhile, the the changed regime that now represented Ukraine was to be bolstered with $17.1 billion loan from the International Monetary Fund and an increased U.S. military presence in neighboring Poland. Immediate disbursement by the IMF of $3.2 billion will allow Ukraine to avoid a potential debt default. In other words, it will protect the rich creditors, not the Ukrainian taxpayers. It will enable Ukraine to pay its maturing debts by going still deeper into debt. As the weeks went on, Obama was now making it clear that all decent nations had to stand up to Moscow and challenge the way that Russia was behaving. Someday we might have a U.S. president who does not use diplomacy to play the irate schoolmaster, who does not patronize or scold one of the other countries with complaints about their behavior. The presumption that the U.S. leaders have no questionable motives, no hidden agendas of any kind, self-explanations is not in order. But others have examined things. Putin himself on 29 April 2014 remarked that Washington was behind Ukrainian events all along. Though keeping low, I think what is happening now shows us who really was mastering the process from the beginning. The U.S. Empire's ultimate intent is to encircle and reduce Russia to a frightened and discombobulated satellite. But that is much easier said than done. At this time, as I write, Moscow reportedly no longer accepts telephone calls from the White House. Meanwhile, protests against the NATO-supported Ukrainian regime are on the rise. Anti-Kiev activists are seizing Ukraine's acting president, are seizing administrative buildings, and calling for the referendum on federation. Ukraine's acting president, Alexander Turchynov, put the Ukrainian army on full alert due to the threat of a Russian invasion. Turchynov admitted that the government in Kiev could not control the situation in eastern Ukraine. It did not even seem able to control the situation in Kiev itself. Obama may have a few tricks and trumps left to play, but he is fishing in troubled waters and might invite more danger and tribulation than he or we can handle. As Putin put it, the situation is serious and we need to find serious approaches to the solution. That is an end to a section here, so start off next week with a new section. Looks like by three different contributors. So, I'm not even going to play a song, Annie. I'm just going to drop the stream for you to take over. So, thanks for coming out, everyone, and hope to see everyone tomorrow with me and Roger.